It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The University of Pittsburgh plans to reopen classrooms this fall, and one 2020 graduate wants the school to require all undergraduates to take a class in Black Studies as a graduation requirement. Sydney Massenburg launched a petition on change.org that's drawn more than 6,100 signatures. Sydney's on the line with me now. Thanks for being here, Sydney.
Of course. I'm so happy to be here.
And also joining us is Dr. Yolanda Covington Ward. She is the chair of the Department of Africana Studies at Pitt. Welcome back to The Confluence, Dr. Covington Ward.
Thank you, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be here.
Sydney, let's start with you. You also wrote a letter to university administrators saying that some of your white classmates made comments in some classes that you call plainly misinformed or even offensive. Can you give me an example?
One of the examples that stands out to me the most was in a class about African-American history, where we were discussing historically Black colleges and universities, and one student said that historically Black colleges and universities are segregation created by Black people. That was offensive to me and others, I'm sure, because in reality, HBCUs were established when most schools were closing their doors to Black students.
How would you describe, Sydney, your fellow students' knowledge in general of Africana history? Do many even want to learn more?
I think in general, the knowledge is definitely not where it could be because these classes are optional to most students. In my circle, personally, I have met a lot of people who are willing to have these conversations with me.
Why is this important to you?
This is important to me because I started at Pitt in 2016, and it didn't take me very long to realize that not only was my school very underpopulated by Black students and faculty, but one of the places where I saw the most Black people and non-Black people of color was in these courses centered on race issues and race-focused topics. And this bothered me because it obviously isn't only the responsibility of minorities to address this unique and complicated set of issues, and it's concerning when people don't know and understand the full extent of the issue because of how deeply it's rooted in American society, and that can sometimes cause people to underestimate it and falsely believe that solving it is simple.
Dr. Covington Ward, how would you describe the makeup of undergraduate classes in Africana Studies? Who's taking these classes?
There are some classes where you might see more students who are non-white, and then there's other classes that are a complete mix. We have students who are white students, Black students, students of all different racial and ethnic backgrounds who take our classes. And I think that it's really important for all of these students to be there in order to learn about really, really important concepts and topics like anti-Black racism, like institutionalized and systematic racism, white supremacy and privilege, state-sponsored violence. All of these different things are topics that we cover in our courses every day and in our programming as well. As important as these courses are, we also have to ask questions or look at where resources are allocated. Our department is one of the smallest departments. And I think that as students ask more and more questions about these issues and topics that are so key for understanding race relations and institutionalized racism and systemic racism in our country, we really need to see and have more resources provided for those tough conversations.
If you were designing this required Black Studies class to be part of a graduation requirement, what would be a key factor in that class?
There are a number of different things that could be included. You can think about the philosophies of people like Martin Luther King Jr. with letters from Birmingham Jail. You can think about Frantz Fanon, who was an anti-colonialist from Martinique, who talked about the impact of colonization on people's mindsets in books like Black Skin, White Mask, and The Wretched of the Earth. We can think about Malcolm X. We can think about the Cumbie River Collective, which released a group of Black women who released a Black feminist statement about how their identities rest at the intersection of race, gender, and a number of other dimensions that need to be taken account of. Michelle Alexander, in her book, The New Jim Crow, which is really about mass incarceration and how it's been really impacted Black communities across the country and has been done intentionally in terms of really decimating these communities and taking especially black men, but also black women, and incarcerating them at much higher rates than other members of the population. So I think we have a number of different resources we can draw upon to look not just historically at the experiences and initiative of people of African descent, but also about look at the challenges that we face today as well.
Sydney, how would a class, in your mind, help an 18-year-old understand what's happening now with Black Lives Matter, et cetera?
There are definitely a lot of students that come to Pitt and go to other colleges as well who have never experienced or been exposed to people who are different from them. And some people have never been made aware of how their actions and interactions with others, specifically members of historically marginalized groups, can be damaging. And they might have never needed to think about the difference between the way they exist on account of their race and background as opposed to people of other backgrounds. So a lot of people are coming to terms with that right now. Attacking this early on in the college experience could definitely be helpful and encourage students to really think big picture and think outside of their own experiences.
For both of you, would a class like this help students find the words to have a better understanding, to have conversations they should have or might want to have? Dr. Covington Ward, let's start with you.
Yes, I definitely think such a class would do that. And I think really it's about starting this process of self-reflection, but also this willingness to see people as human like yourself. And I think that's one of the hugest problems that we have as a society in terms of anti-black racism, in the sense that people of African descent are dehumanized, you know, constantly portrayed as if they're not the same as everyone else. They don't have the same feelings, the same desires, and that is what makes it so easy to brutalize them and us, because I'm one of them.
Sydney?
I definitely agree with all of that. A lot of the time when people don't know enough and don't have the context to participate in conversations like this, they would rather just shy away from these conversations out of fear of maybe embarrassing themselves. Having classes like these where the environment is meant to be supportive and constructive will definitely help students find the words to be able to have these conversations and continue these conversations once they leave the classroom as well.
Sydney, I believe you're headed to law school this fall. Is this effort a one-time thing to get this course requirement, or you plan to make other efforts like this a part of whether it's your career or part of your life?
This is definitely not going to be a one-time thing. I'm at the least hoping to direct my maybe pro bono efforts toward minority issues in general. I want to focus on the criminalization of poverty, which is so closely linked to different marginalized groups. I think specifically for me, homelessness is what strikes a chord with me, so we'll see, but I'll have to figure that out in a few years.
Sydney Massenberg is a 2020 graduate of the University of Pittsburgh, and Dr. Yolanda Covington Ward is chair of the Department of Africana Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. Thanks to both of you for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin, and thank you, Sydney.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Natural gas production across Appalachia has declined by the largest amount of any basin in the nation. That's according to new data from analytics firm Enverus. However, Enverus does say the outlook for natural gas prices in 2021 is optimistic. Paul Goff is a reporter with the Pittsburgh Business Times. So, Paul, let's start with that one bit of hope. What signals do they see that could mean a possible rise in natural gas prices over the coming months? I mean, natural gas prices have been off by about 20% this year, right?
Yes. And if you look at what's happening now, there's not a lot of reason to be optimistic. Natural gas demand comes from several factors, whether it's, you know, the natural gas that you have in your home for heating in the winter or for power plants to provide electricity. And about half of that demand also comes from manufacturers and others who use natural gas in their industries. Mm-hmm. And while it wasn't a very cold winter and that dampened demand, the markets might think that could change next winter. And they also expect enough of a recovery for manufacturing the industry that will continue to need natural gas. And the prices for future natural gas delivery near to the end of the year and then into next year right now seem to support that.
All right, Paul, you talked to Nicholas Deulis, CEO of CNX Resources. He said to you that low natural gas prices, the shutdown, and the balance sheets of many drillers amount to a perfect storm for the industry. How many drillers were over-leveraged facing financial challenges before the pandemic even hit?
Well, financing and leveraging has been a concern for a while in the shale industry, not just here in Appalachia, but also around the country. And these companies have spent billions of dollars for the past decade exploring and drilling for natural gas. And Wall Street a few years ago got tired of bankrolling it without the promise of a lot of money back to them. Now, we haven't seen the reckoning necessarily in the Appalachian Basin that's been predicted in terms of companies either cratering or merging, but some experts think that's coming.
Does that mean that drillers will be shutting down their Pennsylvania wells this year and in turn cutting jobs?
There haven't been a lot of job cuts this year among the drillers themselves. They've had to right size in the last several years because this is not just a COVID-19 or an economic crisis kind of story. It's been sort of playing out over the last several years. Some of them are not necessarily going to shut down wells, but they'll curtail production until prices get better. They're hoping that the natural gas prices are strong enough at the end of the year and into 2021 that they'll be paid more for the gas now, because a lot of it doesn't go into storage. A lot of it is used as it is produced or delivered.
Right. So curtailing production, though, does that mean cutting jobs, at least temporarily?
If it's not cutting jobs, it depends on how lean the company is. You can't necessarily make that statement because the production has already been drilled and hydraulically fractured. However, EQT is curtailing about 25% of its production for at least a little while. EQT is based here in Pittsburgh, but it's also the largest natural gas producer in the country. So what it decides to do is a big deal. And they're hoping that the prices are going to get better later. So why produce the gas now if you can keep it in the ground?
Paul Goff is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Business Times. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you, Kevin. Always a pleasure.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The coronavirus has hit hardest in nursing homes, where most of Pennsylvania's COVID-19 deaths have occurred. There's been a slow shift away from nursing homes for years, and now the pandemic is making it easier and more attractive to get care at home. For Keystone Crossroads, Nina Feldman and Laura Benshoff have this story on two families who made that decision. Nina starts us off.
When his father tested positive for the coronavirus in February, John Stagliano knew he wouldn't be able to convince him to go to the hospital.
He just didn't want to be there. Any time he ever went was when something bad happened.
Luckily, their hospital set the 82-year-old up with intensive care at his home in Chester County, an oxygen machine, and an app to remotely monitor his vital signs.
So mom was taking care of him. He's got like a man cave in the basement. That's kind of where he lives. And, you know, they put the oxygen down there for him, but he was sleeping on the sofa and mom was just running up and down the steps.
After a couple of weeks, Stagliano's mother, Catherine, came down with the virus too. So he moved from Reading to stay nearby and care for both of his parents at home. Not everyone has this option. It's common for COVID-19 patients to rehab in nursing homes where they can be monitored 24/7. Those are the same nursing homes that were ravaged by the coronavirus. In Pennsylvania, 2/3 of deaths happened here.
I think that nursing homes as we know them are over.
That's Rachel Werner, a health policy expert at the University of Pennsylvania who has focused on elder care. When the pandemic hit, hospitals shifted a lot of health care into the home to free up valuable bed space. Medicare loosened restrictions on telehealth so doctors could bill for remote appointments. Werner and other experts are finding it harder to imagine someone choosing to go to a nursing home after, say, a hip replacement, if now they know they could get the care at home.
In the next year or two, I think that we're going to find that nursing homes are going to have to close because there's just not going to be as much demand for the care that they provide.
But home health care relies heavily on family members. During the pandemic, while many are out of work, that's been easier. But taking care of a family member at home indefinitely can be scary and isn't always realistic. My colleague Laura Benshoff talked to one couple who struggled with that choice.
Peter Foster and his wife Drew had been married for nearly 30 years when she called him while walking the dog last October, complaining of chest pains.
And then she said, I'm not going to the emergency room. And I'm like, why are you talking about an emergency room? What is going on?
By the time he ran outside to meet her, Drew had had a heart attack, suffering brain damage that would require years of intensive rehabilitative therapy. Initially, she couldn't speak and barely moved, but she did respond to music.
You know, the greatest moment was when my daughter put on some James Brown, and she wasn't really verbal at that time, and she was moving just a bit, and she, right on cue, when he went, woo, so did she, and her hand went up in the air, and I was like, whoa.
Peter took off work to spend time with her at a rehabilitation facility every day, but when COVID-19 hit, visitors were banned. In a few short days, he says his wife's speech became more garbled. Without the constant presence of her family, she was regressing. So despite his fears that he couldn't take care of her well enough, Peter brought his wife home.
It's just the fear also, you know, middle of the night, what happens if something goes wrong? I'm not in a hospital, I'm not in a facility anymore.
Over the last 20 years, Pennsylvania has shifted its long-term care funding away from nursing homes and towards home care. Baby boomers are getting older and need somewhere to age safely. If they all went to nursing homes, that would be expensive for state governments. Kevin Hancock with the Pennsylvania Office of Long-Term Living says the shift is also driven by what people want.
People express the desire to be able to age in place as much as possible in their homes and in their communities.
But parts of the system still favor nursing homes. Medicare rewards hospitals for keeping people from coming back, so hospitals send people to nursing homes in hopes that being monitored 24/7 will keep them healthy. Hancock says there are other hurdles to home care as well, namely a shortage of workers.
It's a critical problem, and I would attribute it largely to inadequate wages, benefits, and training.
The Fosters depend on two home health aides during the day. At night, it's just Peter. But he says there's no going back now.
The fact that I can run down during a work call and, you know, spend some time with her, give her some hugs and kisses and bring her some food or something or listen to music is huge.
You got to pay back.
Last month, they celebrated their 29th wedding anniversary, playing their favorite albums at home. Laura Benchoff
and Nina Feldman, Keystone Crossroads.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you enjoy what you're hearing, there's even more to read on our website at WESA.fm, where our newsroom is rounding up everything you need to know about how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting our region and beyond. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at WESA.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Joe Yazenkovich, and Doug Shugerts. Until next time, I'm Kevin Gavin. Hope you have a good day of good news.